22. Braun Lamia found her four-hour walk turning into a ten-hour nightmare. First, there was the diversion to the dead city and the difficult choice of leaving Silenus behind. She did not want the poet to stay there alone. She did not want to force him to go on, nor to take the time for a return to the tombs. As it was, the detour along the ridgeline cost her an hour of travel time. Crossing the last of the dunes and the rock barrens was exhausting and tedious. By the time she reached the foothills, it was late afternoon and the keep was in shadow. It had been easy descending the 661 stone stairs from the keep 40 hours earlier. The ascent was a test even of her lusus-bred muscles. As she climbed, the air grew cooler, the view more spectacular, until by the time she was 400 meters above the foothills, she was no longer perspiring, and the valley of the Time Tombs was in sight once again. Only the tip of the crystal monolith was visible from this angle, and that as an irregular glimmer and flash of light. She stopped once to make sure that it was not truly a message being flashed, but the glimmers were random, merely a panel of crystal catching the light as it dangled from the broken monolith. Just before the last 100 stairs, Lamia tried her comm log again. The comm channels were the usual hash and nonsense, presumably distorted by the time tides, which broke down all but the closest of electromagnetic communications. A comm laser would have worked. It seemed to work with the console's antique comm log relay. But besides that single machine, they had no comm lasers now that Kassad had disappeared. Lamia shrugged and climbed the final stairs. Kronos Keep had been built by Sad King Billy's androids. Never a true keep. It had been intended as a resort, travel-in, and artist's summer haven. After the evacuation of the City of Poets, the place had remained empty for more than a century, visited only by the most daring of adventurers. With the gradual waning of the Shrike menace, tourists and pilgrims had begun to use the place, and eventually the Church of the Shrike reopened it as a necessary stop on the annual Shrike pilgrimage. Some of its rooms, carved deepest in the mountain or atop the least accessible of turrets, had been rumored to be the site of arcane rituals and elaborate sacrifices to that creature the Shrike cultists called the Avatar. With the imminent opening of the tombs, wild irregularities of the time tides, and evacuation of the northern reaches, Kronos Keep had again fallen silent. And so it was when Braun Lamia returned. The desert and dead city were still in sunlight, but the keep was in twilight as Lamia reached the bottom terrace, rested a moment, found her flashlight in her smallest pack, and entered the maze. The corridors were dark. During their stay there 2 days earlier, Kassad had explored and announced that all power sources were down for good. Solar converters shattered, fusion cells smashed, and even the backup batteries broken and strewn about the cellars. Lamia had thought of that a score of times as she hiked up the 603 stairs, glowering at the elevator nacelles frozen on their rusted vertical tracks. The larger halls, designed for dinners and gatherings, were just as they had left them, strewn with the desiccated remains of abandoned banquets and the signs of panic. There were no bodies, but browning stakes on stone walls and tapestries suggested an orgy of violence not too many weeks before. Lamia ignored the chaos, ignored the harbingers, great black birds with obscenely human faces, taking wing from the central dining hall, and ignored her own fatigue as she climbed the many levels to the storeroom where they had camped. Stairways grew inexplicably narrower, while pale light through colored glass cast sickly hues. Where the panes were shattered or absent, gargoyles peered in as if frozen in the act of entering. A cold wind blew down from the snowy reaches of the bridal range and made Lamia shiver under her sunburn. The packs and extra belongings were where they had left them, in the small storeroom high above the central chamber. Lamia checked to make sure that some of the boxes and crates in the room contained non-perishable food items, and then she went out onto the small balcony, where Lenore Hoyt had played his balalaika so few hours, such an eternity, ago. The shadows of the high peaks stretched kilometers across the sand, almost to the dead city. The valley of the time tombs and the jumbled wastes beyond still languished in evening light, boulders and low rock formations throwing a jumble of shadows. Lamia could not make out the tombs from here, although an occasional glimmer still sparkled from the monolith. She tried her comlog again, cursed it when it gave her only static and background garble, and went back in to choose and load her supplies. She took 4 packs of basics wrapped in flow foam and molded fiber plastic. There was water in the keep. The troughs from the snowmelt far above were a technology which could not break down, and she filled all of the bottles she had brought and searched for more. Water was their most serious need. She cursed Silenus for not coming with her. The old man could have carried at least 6 water bottles. She was ready to leave when she heard the voice. Something was in the grand hall, between her and the staircase. Lamia pulled on the last of the packs, pulled her father's automatic pistol from her belt, and went slowly down the staircases. The hall was empty. The harbingers had not returned. Heavy tapestries, stirred by the wind, blew like rotted pennants above the litter of food and utensils. Against the far wall, a huge sculptor of the shrike's face, all free-floating chrome and steel, rotated to the breeze. Lamia edged across the space, swiveling every few seconds so that her back was never turned to one dark corner for long. Suddenly, a scream froze her in her tracks. It was not a human scream. The tones ululated to the ultrasonic and beyond, setting Lamia's teeth on edge and making her grip the pistol with white fingers. Abruptly, it was cut off, as if a player beam had been lifted from a disc. Lamia saw where the noise had come from. Beyond the banquet table, beyond the sculpture, under the 6 large stained glass windows where the dying light bled muted colors, there was a small door. The voice had echoed up and out, as if it had escaped from some dungeon or cellar far below. Braun Lamia was curious. All of her life had been a conflict with inquisitiveness above and beyond the norm, culminating in her choice of the obsolete and sometimes amusing profession of private investigator. More than one time her curiosity had led her into embarrassment or trouble or both, and more than a few times her curiosity had paid off in knowledge few others had. Not this time. Lamia had come to find much-needed food and water. None of the others would have come here. The 3 older men could not have beaten her here, even with her detour to the dead city. And anything or anyone else was not her concern. Kassad? She wondered, but stifled the thought. That sound had not come from the throat of the Force Colonel. Braun Lamia backed away from the door, keeping her pistol ready, found the steps to the main levels and descended carefully, moving through each room with as much stealth as is possible while carrying 70 kilos of goods and more than 12 water bottles. She caught a glimpse of herself in a faded glass on the lowest level, squat body poised, pistol raised and swiveling, a great burden of packs tottering on her back and dangling from broad straps, bottles and canteens clanking together. Lamia did not find it amusing. She breathed a sigh of relief when she was out on the lowest terrace, out in the cool, thin air, and ready to descend once again. She did not need her flashlight yet. An evening sky suddenly filled with lowering clouds shed a pink and amber light on the world, illuminating even the keep and the foothills below in its rich glow. She took the steep stairs 2 at a time, her powerful leg muscles aching before she had reached halfway. She did not tuck the gun away, but kept it ready should anything descend from above or appear in an aperture in the rock face. Reaching the bottom, she stepped away from the staircase and looked up at the towers and terraces 0.5 kilometer above. Rocks were falling toward her. More than rocks, she realized, gargoyles had been knocked off their ancient perches and were tumbling with the boulders, their demonic faces lighted by the twilight glow. Lamia ran, packs and bottles swinging, realized that she had no time to reach a safe distance before the debris arrived, and threw herself between two low boulders leaning against one another. Her packs kept her from fitting all the way beneath them, and she struggled, loosening straps, aware of the incredible noises as the first of the rocks struck behind her, ricocheted overhead. Lamia pulled and pushed with an effort that tore leather, snapped fiber plastic, and then she was under the boulders, pulling her packs and bottles in with her, determined not to have to return to the keep. Rocks the size of her head and hands pelted the air around her. The shattered head of a stone goblin bounced past, smashing a small boulder not 3 meters away. For a moment, the air was filled with missiles. Larger stones smashed on the boulder above her head, and then the avalanche was past, and there was only the patter of smaller stones from the secondary fall. Lamia leaned over to tug her pack further into safety, and a stone the size of her comm log ricocheted off the rock face outside, skipped almost horizontally toward her hiding place, and bounced twice in the small cave her shelter made, then struck her in the temple. Lamia awoke with an old person's groan. Her head hurt. It was full night outside, the pulses from distant skirmishes lighting the inside of her shelter through cracks above. She raised fingers to her temple and found caked blood along her cheek and neck. She pulled herself out of the crevice, struggling over the tumble of new fallen rocks outside, and sat a moment, head lowered, resisting the urge to vomit. Her packs were intact, and only one water bottle had been smashed. She found her pistol where she had dropped it in the small space not littered with smashed rocks. The stone outcrop on which she stood had been scarred and slashed by the violence of the brief avalanche. Lamia queried her comm log. Less than an hour had elapsed. Nothing had descended to carry her away or slit her throat while she lay unconscious. She peered one last time at the ramparts and balconies, now invisible far above her, dragged her gear out, and set off down the treacherous stone path at double time. Martin Silenus was not at the edge of the dead city when she detoured to it. Somehow, she had not expected him to be. Although she hoped he had merely gotten tired of waiting and had walked the few kilometers to the valley. The temptation to take off her packs, lower the bottles to the ground and rest a while was very strong. Lamia resisted it. Her small automatic in her hand, she walked through the streets of the dead city. The explosions of light were enough to guide her way. The poet did not respond to her echoing shouts. Although hundreds of small birds Lamia couldn't identify exploded into flight, their wings white in the darkness, she walked through the lower levels of the king's old palace, shouting up stairways, even firing her pistol once, but there was no sign of Silenus. She walked through courtyards beneath walls heavy laden with creeper vines, calling his name, hunting for some sign that he had been there. Once, she saw a fountain that reminded her of the poet's tale about the night sad King Billy disappeared, carried off by the shrike. But there were other fountains, and she could not be sure this was the one. Lamia walked through the central dining hall, under the shattered dome, but the room was dark with shadows. There was a sound, and she swiveled, pistol ready, but it was only a leaf or ancient sheet of paper blowing across ceramic. She sighed and left the city, walking easily despite her fatigue after days without sleep. There was no response to comm log queries, although she felt the déjà vu tug of the time tides and was not surprised. The evening winds had eradicated any tracks Martin might have left on his return to the valley. The tombs were glowing again, Lamia noticed, even before she reached the wide saddle at the entrance to the valley. It was not a bright glow, nothing to compare to the silent riot of light above. But each of the above-ground tombs seemed to be shedding a pale light, as if releasing energy stored during the long day. Lamia stood at the head of the valley and shouted, warning Saul and the others that she was returning. She would not have refused an offer to help with the packs for this last 100 meters. Lamia's back was raw, and her shirt was soaked with blood where the straps had cut into flesh. There was no answer to her cries. She felt exhaustion as she slowly climbed the steps to the Sphinx, dropped her gear on the broad stone porch, and fumbled for her flashlight. The interior was dark. Sleeping robes and packs lay strewn about in the room where they had slept. Lamia shouted, waited for the echoes to die, and played her light around the room again. Everything was the same. No, wait. Something was different. She closed her eyes and remembered the room as it had been that morning. The Mobius cube was missing. The strange energy-sealed box left behind by Hetmastine on the wind wagon was no longer in its place in the corner. Lamia shrugged and went outside. The shrike was waiting. It stood just outside the door. It was taller than she had imagined, towering over her. Lamia stepped out and backed away, stifling the urge to scream at the thing. The raised pistol seemed small and futile in her hand. The flashlight dropped unheeded to the stone. The thing cocked its head and looked at her. Red light pulsed from somewhere behind its multifaceted eyes. The angles of its body and blades caught the light from above. "You son of a bitch," said Lamia, her voice level. "Where are they? What have you done with Saul and the baby? Where are the others?" The creature cocked its head the other way. Its face was sufficiently alien that Lamia could make out no expression there. Its body language communicated only threat. Steel fingers clicked open like retractable scalpels. Lamia shot it 4 times in the face, the heavy 16-millimeter slugs striking solidly and whining away into the night. "I didn't come here to die, you metallic motherfucker," said Lamia, took aim and fired another 12 times, each slug striking home. Sparks flew. The shrike jerked its head upright, as if listening to some distant sound. It was gone. Lamia gasped, crouched, whirled around, nothing. The valley floor glowed in starlight as the sky grew quiescent. The shadows were ink black but distant. Even the wind was gone. Brawn Lamia staggered over to her packs and sat on the largest one, trying to bring her heart rate down to normal. She was interested to find that she had not been afraid, not really, but there was no denying the adrenaline in her system. Her pistol still in her hand, 6 bullets remaining in the magazine, and the propellant charge still strong, she lifted a water bottle and took a long drink. The shrike appeared at her side. The arrival had been instantaneous and soundless. Lamia dropped the bottle, tried to bring the pistol around while twisting to one side. She might as well have been moving in slow motion. The shrike extended its right hand, finger blades the length of darning needles caught the light, and one of the tips slid behind her ear, found her skull, and slipped inside her head with no friction. No pain, beyond an icy sense of penetration.